Kansas City Mayor Sly James has just under a year left in his term, but he's not going quietly. Mayor James has created a bucket list of policies and projects he wants to advance before once again becoming a private citizen. On this list is a series of conversations about racial inequality in our community. His hope is that talking about race and inequity will give the community and office holders the common language necessary for institutional change. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson in for Gina Kaufman, and today on Central Standard, we're talking to Mayor Sly James about these conversations and his goals for them. Welcome, Mayor Sly James. I finally get you in my sights. How are you?
I'm fine, Michelle. How are you?
Great, great.
Good.
So why do you think the city is ripe and ready for this conversation now?
Oh, we were ripe and ready for this conversation a long time ago. Frankly, if anything, I wasn't ready to move forward personally. Not because I didn't want to, but because there were a lot of things on my plate at the time. My staff was really busy trying to execute our agenda. This is part of it. And frankly, it's an appropriate time to do it because there's a lot of anxiety, strife, misunderstanding about race in the air right now. And it's a good time for us to have a conversation to remind ourselves exactly of who we are.
Do you think that because it's a big national conversation that makes it easier to have it as a local conversation?
I don't know if it makes it easier, but it sure made it more more important. I think there was a bigger backdrop. We've had racial issues in the city for as long as I've been in the city, and that's been about 66 years, so it's always been an issue. And there have been attempts to modify our racial positions over the years. I thought that it was important to make this attempt in the context of what's happening nationally and how that might feed us. I simply don't want to see this used as another lever to further divide us in terms of the city. We've come so far working together. I simply wanted to make sure that we recognized each other and the value that we each bring to the table.
When you say we've come so far in working together, what do you mean by that exactly?
I think that we have an attitude in the city now that fosters collaboration at a level where we've not had it before. The problem that I see is that not everyone is involved in the collaboration, when I go to meetings, I see oftentimes very monolithic, and monochromatic, monochromatic.
My coffee hasn't groups. Kicked in yet either.
So. Yeah, I'm with you. but I see these groups of folks who are doing good things, but they're not very diverse. And I wanted to make sure that we recognize that there's talent all over and that we should be trying to find ways to include that talent. That is kind of the way to fully integrate a city, is to get to know each other. And so we thought that having some form of an approach that talked about how we understand each other, how we approach each other, what we understand about each other was important to do if we're going to get over that last hurdle. I was also impressed by the articles that I read in the last year about some young African-American professionals who didn't feel comfortable in certain parts of the city, and I thought it was important to try to address that in a way. And then, of course, we've had the issues with the kneeling during the anthem, which a lot of people have misinterpreted as some sort of disrespect. In fact, I think it is respect. It's respect for what the state, this nation's supposed to stand for. And I think that those types of conversations that seem to go off in such wide different directions, we really ought to talk about more and see if we can bring more of them back towards the middle.
Boy, the middle. How does one even find the middle in these conversations?
I think the best way to find the middle is to listen to each side and to figure out what we can agree on. And I don't think sometimes that we actually do that. We start with what we disagree on and we never make it to the agreement part. If we can figure out those things that we agree on and put all of those things into context, perhaps then it'd be easier for us to understand that we agree on a lot of stuff, and here are a few things that we either don't agree on or don't really understand about each other. We can maybe take those off the table a little bit and start normalizing the conversations between various parts of various people.
So, you know, the obvious, I mean, I've, as you know, I've done racial equity, diversity, inclusion training for years and years and years. And so I've seen a lot of conversations about it.
Sure.
My obvious question is, do you think that you being the mayor maybe puts an extra stamp of credibility on it for people who are unwilling to consider it the same priority that you do?
I don't know that it does or it doesn't. I think that it allows me to be in a better position for convening. But just as many people who might think that me being a mayor is a positive, there's certainly a number that think it's a negative. It's really not about me in any instance. I do have a very clear understanding that oftentimes I'm able to convene something that others may find more difficult. And while I've still got that ability, I plan to use it for good, so to speak. And I think this is something that's worth doing. I'm under no illusions that this is the only, the first, the best. I know that it has its place and hopefully will grow into something that renders good results. But this is a difficult subject for a lot of people. And one of the things that we hope to do is to take the fear, the guilt, the negatives, the angst and anxiety out of the conversation.
So I hear through the grapevine that I have that of the 400 or so open slots for the first form that was about a little over a week ago, that the RSVPs came in rapidly, it was sold out, even though it was a free event.
Sure.
It was sold out within 24 hours. Do you think that's indicative of how interested that people in the community are, indicative of how doubtful people in the community are?
I think it's, if people are doubtful, which tends to be a negative and probably contains a little bit of hopelessness, I think they're more inclined to stay away. I think people who are interested, curious, positive thinking, recognize there's an issue to be discussed, are the ones who would be there. To some extent, it may be a little bit of preaching to the choir, but in any church, you need apostles. And you need people out on the street hailing the good news. And to the extent that we create more apostles and that we recognize how many people really have good, positive thoughts about trying to get over our personal and structural, governmental, and systemic hurdles, the better off we're going to be. We have to have more people who are able to discuss the issue with others who may not be as educated on the issue as they are, in a way that doesn't threaten those who are new to the conversation. So hopefully that's what we're getting through the process that's been established. I do want to say this, and it always needs to be said, is that the folks on my staff, Juan Romero and Jessica and others who worked hard on this, worked their tails off to get this done. I give a lot of praise to them on that.
Great. Thank you. So we already referred to this a little bit, but how does this help the organizations that do this work already that maybe don't get as much attention because they're their own lone wolf, whether as an organization or as a person? How does this help bring these factors who are already working on this issue together?
Well, that's exactly the point in a lot of ways, is that we often find that people working in the same area don't know others who are, or may know them but aren't collaborating. We found that when we started trying to reach out to mentor organizations. Hundreds of mentor organizations, 25% knew about the others, and they were all competing for the same funding. We found that out when we were doing education, that a lot of different groups. But what we've also found is that by convening a meeting, we at least provide a platform and an opportunity for varying groups to meet together, talk together. Hey, what are you doing? We're doing this. Maybe we ought to get together, have coffee, talk about how we can do some things together. And out of those doing things together, build some synergies and some relationships, and also maybe achieve even some efficiencies and of scale by not repeating what somebody else is doing, but using that and providing fill-in services for each group. I don't know how that's going to work, but I do know this, that whenever you have all of the groups or a lot of the groups together, and the groups are skilled at communicating, that I think it's an opportunity for those groups to communicate with themselves and to talk about what they do and how they can do it together. And that's always a good thing in my mind.
So then, of course, that then switches to the obvious question that anybody who has worked in race knows about, which is there's always a contingent of what I call the majority demographic, because I already did a show on how white people don't like to be called white people, so I don't want to start that again. But
although you just did twice, but that's okay.
But the majority demographic, what about the people who go, but why are folks always making things about race?
Well, I think that sometimes people need to understand that a lot of things are, in fact, about race. But, you know, that doesn't mean that you are a racist. It means that you need to recognize that just because you don't feel it doesn't mean that it's not there. I spend a lot of time around women. Why are women talking about things that are women? Should I be upset about that because I'm a man? Not really. Might want to listen in a little bit, learn a little something. But at the end of the day, unless you have experienced the impact of race in this country, it may be difficult for you to relate, but it shouldn't be difficult for you to empathize and vocalize and conversationalize with those who have been impacted so that you learn about it and become more aware of it. You know, you don't have to be totally wired into the racial conversation to recognize the power structure in this country and what it looks like. And it excludes women, white and of color. And it excludes people of color to some extent. And the logical question is, why? And then the next question is, how do we change that? And then the next question is, who do we enlist as allies to get that done? So, people get weirded out whenever the issue of race is brought up. But the issue of race is brought up every single day in this country and in contexts and in ways that people who are not subject to it don't understand. But those who are need to be able to express freely what they're thinking about and how it affects them in a way that doesn't threaten people who are not visiting these ills on them directly, but who may be contributing perhaps indirectly by not even knowing that they're contributing.
So, Mayor, one quick question before break. I was at the first event to the public, and you had mentioned that one of the outcomes that you saw from this that was already happening was city departments improving their ability to deal with race and inequality.
Right.
Could you just give me one quick example of how you see that happening with the city department?
Well, internally, it's been organized so that members of various departments will look at the policies, procedures, and actions of the departments as a whole to figure out where there might be some issues of race. One thing that needs to be done is we have a book of ordinances that are very old, and seldom are those ordinances overturned. They may be ignored because they're outdated. But I think if we were able to go back and look at the body of ordinances from long times ago, we might be able to trace the origins of certain things that have disparate racial impacts through those ordinances and make some corrections in that so that that impact is lessened or alleviated. That's one thing that I think can do. We've already taken some steps with banning the box on employment applications, for example, which has a disparate impact on people of color. So instead of just having the box saying, have you been convicted of a crime or a felony, whatever it said, and then at the end, once you've checked that box, it's over. So that's not necessarily fair. There are some crimes that would exclude, but other crimes may not. But to have a blanket situation like that, where are we applying blanket coverage to to issues that have that then result in disparate impacts? And why are we doing that when we could perhaps be more individualized and specific?
Great. Mayor James, we have to take a quick break, but stick around. When we come back, we'll bring two more voices to the conversation. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson in for Gina Kaufman. We're talking with Kansas City Mayor Sly James. He's hosting a series of conversations about race and inequality. The first one was just over a week ago, and he was joined by Sarah Martin, Deputy Director of the KCMO Health Department, and Paku Herr with the Community Alliance for Racial Equity. They're both with us now. Hey, Sarah. Hello, Paku.
Good morning. Good morning.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. So I'm going to start with you, Paku. One of the things you did in the talk training about a week and a half ago was you started with a basic definition of maybe race. I don't know if race is the right way, but racism.
Mm-hmm.
Why was it important to start with that?
Well, you know, I want to just sort of step back and say, if our strategy in the community is to do scalable education so that people have the information they need to be best equipped to take action, however they take action, then we all need to at least make sure we mean the same things and we use the same words. In 20 years of organizing and doing racial equity work, I have found that people often miss each other because we don't even have a basic definition or framework, or we're not even in the same universe when we're having conversations about race. So that tends to be the most useful way to begin a conversation. Now, I recognize that there were plenty of people in the room for whom that was not a new definition. But if you were there a week and a half ago and I asked the question, how many people for whom are in here have never really thought about institutional racism this way? There were a lot of hands that went up. And so that was, it's critical. One, because you want everybody on the same field to play this game. But two, like, we have to set some bar or expectation for how we're going to have the conversation. Because consistently, people find themselves at odds simply because they don't share a common language or a framework or an analysis of race. And so we knew that was going to be imperative for this initiative. And also, I think at scale, when you're educating people at scale, it's most critical that 400, 500 people at a time at least have some way to understand a concept, an ideology, to understand what's going on in order to even disagree. Maybe you don't agree. Just because we have a common definition doesn't mean that we all agree, but at least you can disagree within the same container.
Could you just tell us what that definition was? I mean, I know this isn't a training session, so you can't get into explaining it, but
yes.
What's the definition?
So the quick and dirty of the definition is that racism equals race prejudice plus the misuse of power. And so, and that's the misuse of power by systems and institutions. So everybody, I said this in, you know, when we were at the Kauffman Foundation, everybody, if you have been shaped or lived any significant portion of your life in the United States, where we do a lot of life based on race, everybody has been socialized to have some biases about race, whether you're a white person or a person of color. But that is different than racism, if you're talking about institutional racism, because that requires one group's racial biases being enforced and projected onto all others by the systems and institutions of that society.
Which is a great segue to Sarah here, because you are with one of the departments that probably sees, I don't know, pretty clearly how race plays out in terms of the system. Could you tell us what is an observation that you've made about that? Because you had some great data in that mm-hmm. in that talk.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you could start just by looking at health outcomes. And I think that's a lot of the conversation that we had was around life expectancy. We don't even get into quality of life or chronic disease outcomes because the concept of how long you live being tied to your skin color, even when we control for things like income or education, that race continues to be an independent, significant predictor of your life expectancy. And so we released some numbers this morning, kind of the newest numbers, and that gap has not budged. Right. So we have come a long way in our conversations, but we have missed the boat when it comes to actually implementing policies that can start to reverse that. And we spend a lot of money on healthcare. We spend a lot of money locally on healthcare. And, you know, we're not getting the returns on that investment because we still see the largest gap is between Black men and white women. And that now stands at about 14 years. And if we just look at men, that's about 9 years. And so on race, on gender, those are intersectional issues. And we're just trying to like bring the data light in a way that people can engage with it and understand it and not get scared of numbers and not get bored is what we're hoping for.
I got to backtrack on that. So you're saying that the average life expectancy between a Black man and a white woman is 14 years. And
yes.
I have to assume from the data I've looked at that that leans towards the white woman having on average 14
yes.
more years living than the average Black man. Wow.
Yeah. So right now, the average life expectancy for a Black man in Kansas City is about 67. Which if we compare that to the average life expectancy of some developing countries is lower. And so not even making it to 70 years old is, I think, should be a call to action. And I think that a lot of that data is what drove the mayor to do, you know, this to start this conversation, because the health department has recognized this for quite a while.
And these are for reasons that are beyond what I think the obvious. I mean, some people I can hear the Facebook conversation now. Well, of course, that's because Black men die more from gun. But we're not talking about that, are we?
No. Homicides, they really contribute for a small proportion of those life year differences. So if we take out all homicides from the equation, we only gain about a year and a half to close that gap. You take out smoking, you close it a little more. When we think about why people do what they do, that is a function of their environment. So this is not a complete, there is no personal responsibility. This is, if I put you in a situation where you have no opportunity to make the right choice, then you will always make the wrong choice. And that doesn't even get into some of the stuff we talked about how your brain actually functions and how it makes decisions and decides whether to do something risky. And when we talk to youth, that's one of the most amazing things. And one of the first projects I ever worked on was talking to youth and asking them, how long do you think you're going to live? And these Black youth, especially men, would say 27. Because to them, that's when their brothers died. That's when their uncles died. And if you think your life is only going to be 27 years, how are you going to spend that? Seeking pleasure, having impulse control issues, like all of these things are mixed up, so that we have to stop as a society blaming the victim of the policies and procedures that we have put in place.
Well, that leads to something else. So most people who are probably listening probably know that Mayor Sly James is Black. I mean, at some point you've seen him on TV or you've seen a photo of him in the media. So, all right. So, I mean, now we've got that off the table. But you two as two people who were upfront in the conversation, and both of you talked about your racial heritage for those listeners who can't see, could you, starting with you, Paku, What's your ethnic racial heritage?
So I'm a second generation Asian American of Hmong descent. My family came here as refugees in the 70s.
Okay.
So I'm a non-Black woman of color.
Okay. Sarah?
My mom is Mexican. So that family came up from Mexico. We did take a DNA test recently, realized we're Peruvian. Everyone's very excited about that. So I told a story, you know, up on stage, is that I never considered myself a woman of color. I grew up in California, where there's a lot of people who are of mixed descent. And I had so many people come up to me at the event and say, I have never heard anybody talk about being half Mexican and not speaking Spanish. And I think it wasn't until I came to Kansas City and met people like Paku that said, you are a woman of color, right? I am a non-Black woman of color whose responsibility and privilege, because I look white, is to bring this data to light, to start talking about these issues, because we don't give a lot of space for Black women of color to have these same conversations. So I see that as my role, because once you know this information, if you sit on it, you don't talk about it, then you're complicit.
So, Mayor James, back to you, because you're still here with us.
I am. And by the way, I am black.
Yes, yes. I'm glad we all confirmed that.
Okay.
So do you think that the race of the people leading these conversations, race and gender, I should say, do you think that that matters in terms of how people hear it, take it in? I can see criticism probably from people who are very into who's on the stage, who's not on the stage.
You know, I live in a world where it doesn't matter who you put anywhere, there's going to be some criticism. So I'm not going to worry about that. I tend to want to find people who know what they're talking about, have the intellect to explain what they're talking about, and the heart and passion for the subject to convey it in a way that people are going to take it in. I didn't spend a whit's moment of time thinking about whether Paku and Sarah were anything other than brilliant women who had something to say. Their race may or may not be important to others. It's not to me. It's important to me in this aspect. It certainly shows, I think, people who may have doubted that there's superior intellect in all forms and packages, and these are just two packages where it happens to reside. So doesn't make any difference to me. If it makes difference to other people, I would encourage them to have that conversation with Sarah and Paku, and maybe they might get a better and a deeper understanding of how it plays out in their lives. I can't speak to it. I'm not a second generation Hmong woman, nor am I Peruvian female. But I think that they have experiences in their lives that might be important to share with others if the conversation comes up.
Well, as we're about to wrap up this conversation, I do have one last question for you, Mayor James. You had mentioned earlier about results. I know you have how many more of these scheduled?
I think we'll have two or three more.
The conversation changes a little bit. I mean, it's not the same thing over and over again, correct?
Right.
It's an evolving conversation, right?
It is. Yeah, the entire strategy, because we're clear we need a strategy, is to give people building blocks for skills, for deeper self-interrogation, for community assessment, and then to launch people into feeling like they have at least some education to help them take action. This is not just to educate people. Like, I have been doing training for over 2 decades, and I always tell people, you cannot train or educate racism away. If we could, we'd have done it a long time ago. So the point is to understand education as a tool people need in order to be successful. Then they do something with that education, whether it's they learn about how to do community organizing, they learn about critical race theory, they learn about the historical context of race. All of that needs to be given to people so they apply it as a tool.
Unfortunately, this is all we have time for today, but I can tell you there is a lot to talk about at future public conversations. We've been talking to Sarah Martin, Deputy Director of the Casey Moe Health Department. Sarah, thank you very much for being here. And Paku Herr with the Community Alliance for Racial Equity. Paku, thanks.
Thank you, Michelle.
And Mayor Sly James. Mayor James, thank you for coming here and talking with us today. After this break, we're talking about the movie Crazy Rich Asians. Have you seen it? What do you think? Call us at 816-235-2888. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson in for Gina Kaufman. Crazy Rich Asians is the first major movie with an all-Asian cast since Joy Luck Club 25 years ago. A lot of Asian Americans have been moved by this representation on the silver screen, and so we wanted to know, what has it meant for Kansas Cityans? Here to discuss it is Annie Watson. Hey, Annie.
Hi.
V-tron.
Hey, Michelle.
What's up, V?
Nothing much, girl.
And Paku Herr. Paku, you're doing double duty today, so thanks for sticking around.
Just hanging out.
If you saw Crazy Rich Asians, what did it mean to you? Call us at 816-235-2888. So I have to start off by saying I am not an Asian American, but I saw it this weekend finally, and I loved it. So I'm just very excited to hear what you guys have to say about it. Okay, which one of you wants to give like a really quick like super quick summary on what the movie is about? Okay, I don't know why there's all this finger point. I'm gonna pick on Annie. Yeah,
okay, Annie. All right, I'll be me. So essentially, it's a romantic comedy about main character's Rachel. She falls in love with a boy. Doesn't realize that the boy is a crazy rich Asian. She goes back to his hometown in Singapore to meet his family. Some drama ensues, and spoiler alert: there is a happy ending.
Oh my God, you just gave away a rom-com's ending. That
I know,
is so,
I'm so sorry.
Wrong. Oh my God. So V, what did you find most significant about this movie?
Well, you know, I think Amy, you and I were talking about how we went into it blind. We didn't want to read any of the hype articles going into it, just so we could see it with fresh eyes. And so for me, it comes down to storytelling. And so I really wanted to see what the execution of this would be. You know, mm-hmm. All this hype was here and it's like, oh man, all this pressure. And I loved it. I loved it. I thought that they knew the story they wanted to tell. They knew how to tell it. And they nailed it from tone to cinematography to specificity in all of the different Asian ethnicities represented. And so I really, really dug it.
The cinematography was absolutely mm-hmm. gorgeous. I mean, that was just so beautiful. So I know how excited, and everybody else knows how excited I was when Black Panther came out, because I knew how big it was to have a movie where it was just seeing mainly all Black people on the screen. There was, you know, the occasional white person, but it was a Black cast with Black writers, Black directors. Paku, how important do you think representation is for Asian Americans?
It's wildly important. I mean, I think when you look at what happens in media and in Hollywood, Asian Americans have very few speaking roles. So to go to a film in which there are Asians and Asian Americans was incredible to me. I mean, it made me think about, I mean, I later took my children, and it made me think about a parallel moment around representation when I took my daughter to see Star Wars, and she freaked out when she saw Kelly Marie Tran and was like, oh my God, another Asian person. And she was 7 when we saw that movie. And so there's incredible meaning for what it means to see somebody with your face on the big screen. And then there's all of what you calculate in, that like it's a blockbuster and it's a mainstream blockbuster and it's making all this money and people are seeing Asian Americans. I think for me, all of that is super important. And I'm not someone who believes that it was Asian America's Black Panther moment. Mm. I would not compare the two films because I think that Black Panther carried in the narrative and in the meaning around blackness in media, a political statement that I think I didn't expect necessarily from mm-hmm. Crazy Rich Asians and didn't need or want from Crazy Rich Asians.
Yeah, I agree.
And so, you know, I've had lots of conversations with people who have said, oh, this is totally our Black Panther. And I'm like, meh, maybe. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't discount the meaning of cultural representation and visibility. But I think we have to be able to parse out what the political differences are.
I mean, that's a great point. I mean, and there was a lot of subtle politics in Black Panther, and a rom-com just doesn't mm-hmm. do that. But sometimes it's just the visuals. Sometimes yes. right. it's just in, because right. that leads to something that I need some help with, guys. I need yeah. some help with. I'm sure that there were cultural, what's it called? Easter eggs, mm-hmm. cultural Easter eggs sure. in the movie that I missed because I was so busy just enjoying the overall movie itself. Can each of you maybe give me a cultural Easter egg that I can go, oh, that's what that meant. Oh, that's all, you know, like whether it was music. I know you're a right. musician, V, so maybe it was music. Maybe it was something in the celebration. I know I went out and had dumplings afterwards, but I mean, that wasn't the movie. I want dumplings every other day. But anything you guys?
Yeah, since you cited music for me. I'll throw this out there and forgive me for not having the citation, but I believe it was in an interview that the director said they were having trouble getting licensing rights for Coldplay's Yellow. You know, there's a cover of Yellow. And forgive me, I'm not Chinese, so I don't know if it was sung in Cantonese or Mandarin, but there's a cover of Coldplay's Yellow, and they were having trouble getting licensing for it. And so he made a personal appeal to the band and the band's management to be like, can we get the rights to this? I don't just need a love song. I need this song because yellow is a loaded word, and I've had to deal with the loaded implications of that word my entire life, and it wasn't until I heard your song recontextualize the meaning of that color and that word in a way that wasn't shameful or hurtful, that made me make peace with that word. And where we have it in the film is tied to a very pivotal moment. And so it serves two purposes for me. And so they got the rights. They got the rights on that appeal.
Wow. I'm going to have to talk to you about that afterwards because that went right over my head.
Yeah.
Exactly. Annie, is there any Easter egg in it for you can explain for those who might not have caught it?
Yeah, so for me, this is a more difficult question because I identify as a biracial, non-black woman of color. I typically don't lead with Asian, although that's kind of my perceived race and ethnicity. But my mother is actually a transracial adoptee who grew up in the South. And so, like Via was saying, I went into the movie with very suspended judgment because I think my underlying sentiment was that this movie wasn't for me, that although I am perceived and treated as an Asian woman, and I very much am an Asian American woman, that those cultural moments I wasn't actually going to understand. And so the Mahjong scene is a great example. Mm-hmm. I had to Google that like every other probably white person or person who's not played Mahjong in the past to really understand the nuances of that. But one thing that really stuck out to me is the significance of the food scene. And part of it was because not so much that those dishes had particular relevance to me as an Asian woman, but the joy of food in our household is actually very significant. And so while I actually grew up eating collard greens in Texas, in a single wide trailer in Lufkin, Texas, in my family gatherings, my husband is a what I call a recovering chef. He's a local chef and bread baker in town. And so food for us is so significant in our own culture. And so to be able to experience the joy of watching people eat and break bread without in such a realistic way was really impactful for me.
Right, right. Yeah. I love the whole making of dumplings as a multi-generational way of bonding and explaining history because in my mind, I thought that's something that probably every culture who bothers keeping culture in the family can relate to. Mm-hmm. Paku, what about you?
So the Mahjong scene is like top on my list too. And for anybody who wants to know all the inner workings of it, I highly suggest people read Jeff Yang's write-up of it.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. But the other scene that really caught me was the opening scene when Michelle Yeoh finds out that her son is going to bring this Chinese American woman home. And all the aunties are in a Bible study. And I was like, oh, this is my childhood. And I think it's so funny because, you know, like as perpetual foreigners, like always the outsider, always like some weird Eastern spiritual thing that happens with Asian Americans. I think people don't understand the way colonization and religiosity and theology has played out in a lot of Asian ethnic communities and how evangelical so many Asian Americans are. And that was really great to see. And I think maybe it would have been a passing thing for some people, or maybe people didn't even maybe like think much about these women sitting together reading the Bible.
Yeah.
But I was like, and you know, I'm a secular humanist now. And I was like, that's my childhood. Right. That's totally it. And like to see a group of older Asian women sitting around and not talking about Buddhism, so it's like everybody's idea of what Asians practice,
right,
was incredibly powerful.
Right. I thought that I did think that because I thought, oh, this is going to throw some folks off. Mm-hmm. This is going to throw some folks off. Now, for me, what was interesting was, and it took me a minute, I think I was probably a quarter into the movie where I was like, Michelle Yeoh, whoa, that's Michelle Yeoh. I mean, and it's like for somebody to be such a really great actress and to go, man, does it have to be 20 years between movies?
Right.
In a way that it isn't for, let's just say, some less talented Hollywood vixens with a lot of Botox. Anybody think about that? I mean, just the actors on the screen?
Well, and Michelle herself said, you know, it's like she said, man, I wish this had happened 20 years ago. because she felt, you know, she's like, I would have made a great Rachel. Like she implied, yes, you know, I would have made a great Rachel.
And I
you
do
know?
All my own stunts.
Like, yeah, but it's like, you know, she said, I'm glad, I wish this would have happened 20 years ago, but I'm glad it's happening now.
Right.
And it makes me remember when I had the privilege of working with Jamie Gwan on M. Butterfly. And he was the original Tony Award-winning choreographer for that show. And he said something to us when he was putting us through Peking Opera Boot Camp. The Broadway production got like 2 months and we got 10 days. but he said, we didn't spend decades kicking down doors for them to be slammed shut on you guys. So we need to do what we can to encourage you, to foster your success in this industry, because we don't want to lose you to attrition to other professions. Because if we do that, then we're back at square one. And we don't, you know, we don't want you to be stuck doing the same six roles in the same six shows forever like we were. You know, we want to foster your future so that you can tell more stories, new stories, richer stories than we had the opportunity to.
Well, and Michelle, I think your question is really, it's one that I've been chewing on, because, you know, I went to Crazy Rich Asians being like, oh, it's just going to be like my Joy Luck Club moment. I'm like 40, in my early 40s now. I saw the Joy Luck Club when I was a teenager, and it was a profound experience. And a lot of folks saying, it's been 20 years since this happened. And I think maybe it's been 20 years since East Asians were on the screen. But we're not the only Asians who make up Asian America.
That's right.
And so, like, people are forgetting what happened with Slumdog Millionaire. What happened with even, like, while Life of Pi had lots of other non-Asian actors in it. Like, there is a deeply Asian story there. And so, like, yes, you know, I already started the conversation saying I'm super stoked that there was this representation of people who look like me. But it's not a full representation or a full narrative about what's happened in Asian American theater or media or filmmaking in the last 20 years, unless we only see East Asians as Asian. And I think that's, like, that's worth critique for even for those of us who are super excited about this, to ask ourselves, do we really only see East Asians as Asians? What about South Asians?
I mean, you raise a good point, because I wanted to make sure before I forgot, and you reminded me, to make sure that you all had the chance to say, but what is your Asian heritage? Because I know that I'm probably as guilty as anybody at going Asian or Asian American, as if that's one kind of Asian. So we'll start with V. What's your background?
First generation Vietnamese American, Vietnamese born refugee.
Okay. And Annie, you said yours a little bit.
Yes, I am half Korean.
Half Korean. Okay. And Baku?
And I'm Asian American, second generation, and my family is Hmong, or Southeast Asian.
So right there, we're talking three different areas of Asia. So we're not talking all Chinese, all Japanese, all, which right there, that's pretty groundbreaking. So what did you think about that in terms of the actors on screen? Because it was a Chinese story, I'm tempted to say Chinese American, but a Chinese story, but yet all the actors on up there weren't Chinese.
Right. And I think that this is an important conversation to have, and we need to hold space so that we can tell more stories, so we can have more accurate representation, you know? For me personally, like right now in the theater scene, Quy Nguyen's Viet Gone is blowing up all over the country, right? Well, there are not going to be enough Vietnamese actors in every single one of those markets. They're going to have to go Pan-Asian with it, you know? And I am okay with that, because it's holding space for the rest of us. You know, it's holding space for the industry in general to catch up. And I think that Constant Wu said about this movie, it's like, yeah, it's an immense amount of pressure and we're not going to get everything right. And you know what? We should have the right to fail, because how many mediocre, how many mediocre movies are out there that tell the same old Caucasian story or the same old whatever story, you know? And they're still being greenlit and produced. And so we're not going to be able to catch all on this one. We just want to make this the best it can be for what it's trying to be.
It's so true. It's so true, because it's the trick bag that every ethnicity that's not white has, where everything has to be representational. So on the one hand, you're happy for the representation, but then you know the burden that's on there. Like, that's great. The Crazy Rich Asians made a mint. and keeps making more money. They're already talking about a sequel. Mm-hmm. But what if it didn't? Would that have made it less worthy an effort?
Right, because there's that dynamic of, okay, you want a seat at the table, you better earn your seat at the table. And if you blow your shot, then it's going to be another 15 years before we give you Asian Americans a seat at the table. And so, yeah, there's an immense pressure to show up and represent with stellar product, or else it sets us all back. And it's hard. It's hard.
Well, and I think there's also this suspended notion that white people cannot see themselves in the narratives of people of color. And so if you look at the casting, right, this happens all the time, specifically in films that in which the story featured an Asian character and then it's whitewashed for films, right? We see that all the time. You could probably think of three or five or more, like just off the top of your head. And so it's this idea that white people, right, can only see themselves. They need that as part of the storytelling. And so this kind of concept of what does narrative plenitude look like for people of color, for Asian people, is really significant.
It sounds like there's a caller who wants to talk about that, too. Hello. Hey, Mary. You're Mary from Kansas City. You there? Mary from Kansas City? All right. Well, then. Oh, there she is. Okay. Mary, you had something to say about the movie?
Yes. I have not seen the movie, but I wanted to say that I'm looking forward to it in the way that the idea of it being sort of like the difference between going to a grocery store in Kansas City and going to the Asian section versus even an Asian market in Kansas City, like a whole Asian market, and the idea of it not feeling strange to shop for what you want to shop for there, versus when I went to Hawaii and I went to a supermarket and there was dehydrated squid next to like the regular beef jerky, and how it's not separated from it all, and I didn't have to go to three different markets to find the things that I wanted. And there was nothing strange about what was like the mix of it in my grocery cart. So even though I haven't seen it, I'm looking forward to sort of being in that experience where I don't feel like it's a stretch for me to understand what that person is going through. But also those Easter eggs that you all talked about were really exciting to sort of like look forward to seeing.
Thank you, Mary. What do you think about that, Paku?
I think it's I appreciate the analogy because I actually never thought about it that way. As in like, you know, we are just there, and part of the plenitude of our stories are part of the fabric of what you find in a field of stories. And I think two things. One, our stories have always been there. So it's not like this is a new and exciting addition to the narrative of people who live in the United States. I think what is different is that we now have marketability in a way where we are visible that maybe didn't exist before. And I don't say that with any kind of like, you know, derision. I just say that I see those as very different things. Because right. Prior to Crazy Rich Asians, all of us had our stories in the mix of what makes this country what it is and the people of this country. It's just whether or not it was yet consumable by other people. And you know, it may sound like I'm critiquing that. And to some degree, maybe I am a little bit, but I do think that there's cultural impact here. Like what it means to not be on the bottom shelf in a special section of Hy-Vee has significance that like, oh, I'm the product at eye level. This is interesting and exciting in lots of ways and worthy of caution or critique or the ability to say all of what is great about Crazy Rich Asians and all of what is problematic. Because like, you know, it's still about like wicked rich Asian people. And feeds a narrative that all people who are Asian are somehow rich in some way or another. And there's fullness of story that I think, you know, it's worthy of us saying, yeah, awesome. And let's dig a little deeper.
I got to say, as we're wrapping up, I got to give a special shout out to Coy Duggar, who's announcing today, because he is an Asian American KCUR employee, and he works with Central Standard, and he was so excited when I said I wanted to do this segment. So, you know, shout out to all the folks who, you know, got to have a little bit of hand in the representation. So thank you so much, Annie Watson, V-Tran, Paku Her. This has been fun. I've loved this conversation. That's all for Central Standard. You can listen back to anything you didn't catch the first time around at kcur.org/Central Standard or anywhere you get your podcast. Keep the conversation going on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Kathleen Pointer, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan. Sophia Gillespie is our intern, and our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, in for Gina Kaufman. Thanks for being with us today.